Hello, and welcome to the second episode of Dissecting Philosophy with Dr. McDonald. Today, we will be discussing the very exciting concept of the Superman in Nietzsche's philosophy. But before we get into the concept of the Superman, let's have a very quick brief going over of what we've already covered. So initially, Zarathustra has come down the mountain after having a nice reflection and think upon things. He's going to then present humanity with a gift. And what this gift is going to be is, of course, the Superman as a concept. He's also had a discussion with a priest in the forest, and ultimately we've reflected upon the tension that Nietzsche has created between philosophy and religion. So let's get cracking on with section 3 of the prologue. When Zarathustra arrived at the nearest of the towns, lying against the forest, he found in that very place many people assembled in the marketplace, for it had been announced that a tightrope walker would be appearing. And thus Zarathustra spoke to the people, "I teach you the Superman. Man is something that should be overcome. What have you done to overcome him? All creatures hitherto have created something beyond themselves, and do you want to be the ebb of this great tide and return to the animals rather than overcome man? What is the ape to men? A laughing stock or a pitiful embarrassment? And just so shall be man to the Superman, a laughing stock or a painful embarrassment. You have made your way from worm to man, and much in you is still worm. Once you were apes, and even now man is more of an ape than any ape." So here we have Zarathustra then saying, "I'm going to teach you the ways of the Superman." And in the German, of course, that's the word of Übermensch, and can also be translated into English as the Overman. And there's also a popular caricature of really Nietzsche himself in this sort of DC Comics Superman attire with a big sort of U for Übermensch across his chest. So let's break down just exactly what's being said here. So Nietzsche's drawn out the tension between man and animals, and that we have historically in philosophy the overcoming of any sort of animality within us as a human species through our use of reason. And an example of that is in Descartes. Descartes' argument is that humans have reason and animals don't have reason. Animals are solely driven through their own desire, and by being driven solely through their own desire, they can't ultimately go beyond that in any given way. So, in a way, animals are just purely carnal, purely instinctually driven creatures. And Descartes says from all that, that animals are basically no better than machines. This is why you have that moment in which it says, what is an ape to man? Isn't it a laughing stock? It's precisely that point to say which, of course, ape is a laughing stock to man, because look at it. Look at it in comparison to us as a human species, and even just what we've done through use of reason, through our intellect, through what we've been able to then create, able to create as a human species in comparison to animals. And interestingly enough, there's the relation to Darwinism here that's going on as well, in which Nietzsche is saying here that even man now is an ape. That is the human species now. Can we have this evolutionary connection back into apes themselves? It's a significant point because Nietzsche's saying here that ultimately what we sought to have is a higher ground, sought to form or create ourselves as a basis for a species above animals. We are no better than apes ourselves, following what Darwin's saying. And this is not in a complimentary fashion here at all. It's not in a sense of, oh, because Darwin then says we have that relation back into apes, it should be like, oh, fantastic, we're animals again. It's no, Nietzsche's more like, oh my God. Like, look what we've become as a species through trying to say that we're superior to animals, and now we're no better than the apes themselves. Continuing on, but he who is the wisest among you, he also is only a discord and hybrid of plant and of ghost. But do I bid you become ghosts or plants? It's a very weird line when suddenly he says the very wisest people, ultimately the philosophers, arguably, or at least let's say, those are who we held in high esteem, are no better than just a combination of plants and ghosts. What does exactly mean here? And I think on the one hand, it's gone back to that point about just satisfying our base instinctual needs for things in a way that a plant, all what it needs is just basic photosynthesis to keep on. In the same way that our own body only needs its own sustenance, own set of nutrients in order to keep on chugging along as it does. And the other part, of course, then the of ghost, what does that mean? It means in relation to the soul. And the idea, ultimately, that our soul is just representative of us in spiritual form, which, despite the many different concepts and ideas of the soul that there is between different philosophies and religious outlooks and that, the one that really is touching upon here is St. Thomas Aquinas' idea, because he's the one in which the soul is ultimately you in spiritual form. So let's keep going. What exactly is Nietzsche? How's Nietzsche going to get us out of this debacle that we're in? Behold, I teach you the Superman. The Superman is the meaning of the earth. Let your will say, the Superman shall be the meaning of the earth. I entreat you, my brothers, remain true to the earth, and do not believe those who speak to you of superterrestrial hopes. They are prisoners whether they know it or not. They are despisers of life, atrophying and self-poisoned men of whom the earth is weary, so let them be gone. So what Nietzsche means here is be wary precisely of the people that speak to us of metaphysics. Be wary of precisely the people that place all the emphasis upon an afterlife. Why is this the case? Because ultimately they're going to lead to us having an unhealthy outlook and unhealthy approach for us. They despise life because there is all that emphasis placed upon an afterlife. Then it's not focused on the here and now. It's not focused precisely on living the best life you have now, but rather preparing you for when you're dead. And Nietzsche's saying here that that's a really just horrible outlook to have. We should be focused on precisely the here and now. We need to be focused on living our lives and having the best life possible now and not for what's going to be happening after we're dead. One's blasphemy against God was the greatest blasphemy. But God died, and thereupon these blasphemers died too. To blaspheme the earth is now the most dreadful offense. And to esteem the bowels of the inscrutable more highly than the meaning of the earth. Once the soul looked contemptuously upon the body, and then this contempt was the supreme good. The soul wanted the body lean, monstrous, famished. So the soul thought to escape from the body and from the earth. Oh, this soul was itself lean, monstrous, and famished, and cruelty was the delight of this soul. But tell me, brothers, what does your body say about your soul? Is your soul not poverty and dirt and a miserable ease? So we have a really nice discussion here about the tension between the body and soul that's going on. And when we have the discussion about the soul seeing the body as something monstrous and harmful and so forth, we have to go back into the history of philosophy and go to an example like Plato's Phaedo. So very briefly, in Phaedo, we've got the death of Socrates. And there we have the discussion which he's very happily going to take the hemlock, the poison that's going to kill him. Why is the body seen as something that's harmful towards the soul? And it goes back into the relationship between desire again and the body. It's ultimately our desires cause suffering for us. And the more that we suffer and the more that we desire, the more that the soul becomes like the body. And for Plato, that was the way in which you couldn't get into the afterlife for regular people, because ultimately they would sin so much through their desires. They would eat far too much packets of crisps. And ultimately philosophy would be the one in which it would get you out of that problem. Why? Because philosophy is the one that teaches you to critically reflect upon things. To have that moment saying, maybe I shouldn't eat that other packet of crisps. Maybe I shouldn't go for the family pack or the fun-sized one. Maybe I should only just eat a wee packet of crisps to myself. That'll be all right. Just those wee moments that you have a critical reflection will not only be healthy for you in the process, of course, but also good for your soul. And the great thing about what Nietzsche does here, he twists it around and he reverses the situation and he says, well, actually, the concept of the soul, when we look at it, let's actually think about it for a minute and just think, my God, doesn't that thing just make us absolutely miserable? Doesn't that actually make us just suffer? Here, of course, we have the irony. And it's something that's meant to alleviate suffering from us. Something that's meant to get rid of suffering ultimately makes us suffer. And precisely the reason that the soul causes suffering for us is because it tries to put shackles on our desire. And the way in which it sees human desire is always causing suffering. And Nietzsche's argument is the complete contrast to that. Our desire is something that's actually really positive for us. It doesn't always lead to suffering. An example here we've got right in the text, in which we have, what does your body say about the soul? Doesn't the body view the soul as something that's ultimately monstrous? It's precisely that point that Nietzsche's trying to say, that within our body itself has a process of desire within it. That is to say, it's going to be keep on trucking. If it gets infected, if it gets caught, if there's an illness, there's an irony to this, of course, when I've got a sore throat, it'll heal itself. It's precisely the desire and processes within our own body. It's a very positive thing. So Nietzsche's then here saying, what's ultimately happened, at least in the history of philosophy, is that we've created this model in which the soul dictates exactly what the body does. And in doing so, we've created this metaphysical model that's tried to dictate what our body does. And can we see the harm precisely in that? Continuing on, in truth, man is a polluted river. One must be a sea to receive, a polluted river and not be defiled. Behold, I teach you the Superman. He is the sea. In him your great contempt can go under. What is the greatest thing you can experience is the hour of the great contempt, the hour in which your happiness grows loathsome to you, and your reason, and your virtue also. The hour when you say, what good is my happiness? It is poverty, and dirt, and a miserable ease, but my happiness should justify existence itself. The hour when you say, what good is my reason? Does it long for knowledge as a lion for its food? It is poverty and dirt and a miserable ease. The hour when you say, what good is my virtue? It has not yet driven me mad. How tired I am of my good and my evil. It is all poverty and dirt and a miserable ease. The hour when you say, what good is my justice? I do not see that I am fire and hot coals, but the just man is fire and hot coals. The hour when you say, what good is my pity? Is not pity the cross upon which he who loves man is nailed? But my pity is no crucifixion. Have you spoken thus? Have you cried thus? Ah, that I had heard you crying thus. It is not your sin, but your moderation that cries to heaven. Your very meanness in sinning cries to heaven. So each little section here of happiness, reason, virtue, justice, pity, there's a lot going on within each little section. First, with happiness, we have the problem of happiness, and the goal of attaining happiness is causing misery. And for that, we have to go into the idea of attaining good life within philosophy. And one example of that is Plato and the emphasis upon the soul and the body, in which we have all the denial of our bodily desire in order to keep our soul pure. And that ultimately will lead us to the best form of the afterlife, because our soul will be pure and therefore can attain heaven. Another model of happiness is that of Aristotle, in which we have Aristotle's argument that happiness is based upon an intellectual life. Nietzsche's criticism of this is quite easy to see. If you have someone like Michael Phelps, ex-Olympic swimmer, what good is an intellectual life going to be to someone who's athletic? Wouldn't that cause them incredible misery to say, wait a minute there, Michael. Actually, you should go read more books. That'll make you much happier than swimming. And that's what Nietzsche's picking up on when we've got models for happiness here, is only a very, very small minority of people that manage to achieve the absolute prime model for what makes happiness possible in these philosophical models. It's certainly not attainable for absolutely everybody. It's quite the opposite. Everybody would be pretty miserable to get to that form of happiness in the first place. Next, the problem with reason is with its lack of thirst, basically, for knowledge, reason used very much like a measuring stick is a corrective tool in order to judge others and their knowledge upon precisely a model. And knowledge in that way has lost its thirst for knowledge. It's no longer become lion-like. All what you're doing is just using knowledge in order to therefore judge other people's as on a corrective model. An easy example of that is just within the easy tick box questionnaire sort of form. When did this happen exactly in history? A, B, C, or D? And then you just tick the right box. As Nietzsche quite rightly points out, what exactly is the thirst in knowledge there? There's no actual thought process that goes into ticking the box. All you're doing is just simply memorizing data and just reproducing that. Next, with virtue. Nietzsche is here, on the one hand, being critical of the way in which you would have to continually adhere to the same principles in which you're trying to uphold. You'd have to continually keep on reminding yourself, I must do this, I must do this, I must do this. And that's why I said, it's not driven me mad yet. And here we can also have the criticism against the ideas of what is good and what is evil. And it touches upon Nietzsche's other book, The Genealogy of Morality. And what Nietzsche says there is that when we have the ideas of good and evil, we tend to think of them as big, pure concepts. That's to say, you've got your knight in shining armor or your Luke Skywalker sort of character, at least in the original trilogy. And then you've got your bad guy, you've got your pure evil bloke, you've got Darth Vader before Jedi. And that's what tends to have happened within philosophy. Everybody talks about good and evil, at least in a moral sense of pure good, pure evil. And Nietzsche comes along and he says, well, actually, what we think is good at a given point in time and what we think is evil in a given point in time is actually based within historical context, and we can genealogically trace the reasons for why we think a thing is good or evil at a given time period. Next, with justice. Nietzsche's being critical here of the just man, his fire and hot coals. And what he means by that is, whenever you see somebody who thinks themselves as incredibly upstanding and just, the amount of almost hellfire that they'll rain down upon somebody who they think is unjust is unbelievable. They don't show them compassion. They don't show them any form of understanding. This goes back into that whole thing of wanting to be absolutely superior in your mindset and principles compared to somebody else. And it's precisely that point in which you can see the amount of condemnation and hatred one person can have for another because they think they're just. I'm going to use a fun example here. So you can get this sense in Batman, in which you've got the idea of Batman and his principles being incredibly superior to that of the villains. You can see exactly what Nietzsche is saying at this point, in which do we see the amount of hellfire and hot coals and so on that he's firing down upon all the villains and what they're doing? He doesn't have a moment of reflection in which he therefore reflects upon his actions. Am I doing the right thing? Is actually pummeling the faces of all these people actually the correct action to do? Next, for pity, we have a great little quote here from
Francesca Cauchy from her book Zarathustra Contra Zarathustra, The Tragic Buffoon. For Nietzsche, pity affords the decadent not only an escape from personal suffering, but also from, little quote, this strange disease of modern life, end quote, and ultimately from life itself. According to Nietzsche, pity is the seedbed of nihilism in all its forms. It's a nice wee quote. So ultimately, we have the initial movement of feeling compassion for someone else. And of course, that allows us an escape from our own personal suffering because we're not the one who's in a horrible situation. It's someone else. Well, the danger then is that our compassion is used against us in a manipulative form in order to then move away from life itself. And one can only reflect upon the way in which Nietzsche has been critical here, and the ways in which religion manipulate your use of compassion, of suffering of others, in order to move away from life itself. For instance, you can see this in the way in which I've had personal experience of Christians knocking at the door, going, isn't that just a horrible thing, death? You go, well, of course it is. And they go, isn't it great how in the end there'll be an afterlife and there'll be a God? You go, I suppose so. And that's exactly what Nietzsche's saying here, that ultimately compassion is the way in which we're nailed to the cross, or another way in which we're manipulated into adopting a set of principles and a view of the world that ultimately takes us out of it. So rounding off the last wee section we have here, where is the lightning to lick you with its tongue? Where is the madness with which you should be cleansed? Behold, I teach you the Superman. He is the lightning, he is the madness. When Zarathustra had spoken thus, one of the people cried, now we've heard enough of the tightrope walker. Let us see him too. And all the people laughed at Zarathustra. But the tightrope walker, who thought the words applied to him, set to work. So at the very end, everybody's like, oh, go away, Zarathustra. Stop talking a load of waffle. But interestingly, what's coming out of the next section is the tightrope walker decides to start off on a wee journey. So rounding off this episode, I'd like to have a wee brief discussion about the difference between DC Comics Superman and Green Lantern, and why you should think of Nietzsche's Superman or Overman more like the Green Lantern. Superman, of course, is an alien who comes to Earth and then precisely through his compassion remains human and therefore not a threat to us as a species. And on the other hand, we have Green Lantern, which the first Green Lantern is Hal Jordan. And plus we have that movie, you know, with Ryan Reynolds before he did Deadpool and so forth. Nevertheless, Green Lantern has got a wee magic ring, and whatever he thinks about, he can manifest in the ring. That's, of course, not the interesting part. The interesting part is that you get one of these rings for Green Lanterns if you have an incredible amount of willpower. And then down from the heaven descends one of these little nice rings that'll pop on your finger. And that's the way in which I'd like people to think more about Nietzsche's Overman or Superman, Übermensch, like the Green Lantern. Someone with an incredible amount of willpower, which is, of course, it's a very famous Nietzsche concept also of will to power. And we could precisely just understand it in the way in which it's that will to life. That is something there's very much bodily, worldly, in contrast to Superman, who is much more a metaphysical being. A good defense can be made, of course, from the Superman fans to say, well, actually, Superman is, of course, a great character and fights for the greater good for everybody. But from Nietzsche's perspective, you can see how that compassion precisely could lead into his manipulation and lead into humanity's downfall. And we have a great example of that in the Injustice comic, as well as the video game series, where Superman is the bad guy. And of course, there's a great series written by Tom Taylor. Highly recommended to have a wee check out if you've not checked it out already. So thank you very much for listening to the podcast. I hope you found it enjoying and insightful to have a wee blather about one section for about over half an hour. The podcast can be found on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher. I've tried to get up to Google Podcasts, but if anybody can give me a wee hand, that'd be great. Because it says it's currently locked off to just US only. And feel free to drop me a wee email as well at dissectingphilosophy@gmail.com. And I'm also on Twitter as I Am A Rubber Man. So thank you very much for listening, and I hope you join us next time.